Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on a shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with France 24. 2 press reviews. The first is about the meeting between South African President Cyril Ramaphosa and Donald Trump, which turned controversial with Trump's claims of genocide. The second deals with the British government making deals on defense, fisheries, and energy with the European Union. This is seen as a Brexit reset 9 years after the Brexit vote created a serious rift in the UK and Europe. France 24.
Lots of reactions in the South African press today, of course, after President Cyril Ramaphosa's meeting with Donald Trump in the White House.
Yeah, that's right, Stuart. The Mail and Guardian, a South African daily, offers a sort of blow-by-blow account of how that meeting was conducted. It started off cordial enough. Ramaphosa even brought along 2 South African golf stars as a nod to Donald Trump's love for the sport. But things veered off course, the paper reports, after a journalist asked Donald Trump what it would take to see that there isn't a genocide in South Africa, to which Ramaphosa said it would take listening to South Africans. And right on cue, Donald Trump then said, I've got a video to show you. He showed him this video that he claims is proof of calls for a white genocide in South Africa, clips of South African politician Julius Malema chanting an anti-farmer song. The video, Donald Trump reported, also showed the burial sites of 1,000 white farmers. In reality, though, it was actually images of a memorial procession from September 2020 that had nothing to do with what Donald Trump was talking about.
What are the reactions then, Dipti, from the South African front pages?
Well, what you have is one word that really stands out, and it's here, ambushed, as the Daily News says. This is how many of the South African papers feel about Donald Trump's treatment of Ramaphosa. This is from the Sowetan, again, using that word ambush, but it says that a calm Cyril survived Donald Trump's ambush, and the paper rather applauding the way the South African leader was able to, quote, stage a pushback against the lies of a white genocide in South Africa. And this paper here, The Herald, also focusing on this, saying that Donald Trump really blindsided Ramaphosa with that clip of Malema singing. Now, in its opinion pages, the paper has printed a very strong letter from a reader to the editor of the paper. It's just at the bottom here, this article entitled Post-Apartheid Policies Cannot Be Considered Genocide. And in this article, a reader writes to the editor using the word genocide when, I quote, equity is pursued is a gross misrepresentation and betrayal of the truth. The reader adding, Trump does not know our story nor our sacrifices. And finally, in the New York Times, this analysis from the Times, which sees Donald Trump as casting himself as a protector of the persecuted white people, the Times saying he really dressed down the South African leader by alluding to this fringe conspiracy theory.
Dipti found mixed reactions from the British papers today after the EU and Britain shook hands on a deal concerning defence, fisheries and energy as well.
Well, this is the front pages really say it all. So Britain and EU turn a page with the Brexit reset deal. That's what the Independent says here on its front page. The Financial Times also quite triumphant. UK and EU agree post-Brexit reset of trade links at Showpiece Summit. So really underpinning how symbolic this moment was, coming 9 years, of course, after that fateful Brexit referendum vote. You also have this analysis here from The Guardian which says, you know, that Sir Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister's post-Brexit reset offers clear benefits, but that there are political risks too. In particular, it says, it alludes to the fact that he recognized for the first time yesterday something that his predecessors have denied for years, that Brexit damaged Britain. But the paper says in doing so, he also risks being accused of betrayal by his rivals and voters in finding this sort of consensus with EU leaders yesterday.
Dipti, I suspect not all the papers are saying the same thing. What are the pro-Brexit papers saying?
Well, look at this here on the Daily Telegraph. Kiss goodbye to Brexit. Quite literally, this is a picture of Keir Starmer and Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission President, embracing each other. So Daily Telegraph certainly sees it as a betrayal. The Daily Express uses the word betrayal here on its front page. Keir's abject surrender is a betrayal of Brexit, Britain, it says. And the paper's really upset about the agreement on fisheries, notably that there will be a sort of cooperation between EU and the EU and Britain when it comes to fisheries. It says that back in 2016, Britain voted Brexit to leave the EU, notably to take back control of its fishing industry, and that the deal now will essentially undo all of that. While The Sun decides to go with a fishing pun, it says, done up like a kipper on its front page, basically saying, you know, Starmer has agreed to do all these things, pay billions for privilege, bow down to EU judges, but in return we'll get very little.
Those press reviews were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, and most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. A group of Western diplomats were inspecting the Israeli-occupied West Bank when Israeli soldiers fired shots in their direction. 20 Israeli allies signed a letter demanding a full resumption of aid into Gaza immediately, and the UK government called the situation intolerable. Then an interview with Mustafa Barghouti, a Palestinian physician and politician, Secretary General of the Palestine National Initiative. He says that the whole world is fed up with the massacres being perpetrated in Gaza, leading to huge demonstrations in Europe and the U.S. He talks about Yoav Gallant, the former Minister of Defense. He says Palestine will have democratic elections when Israel leaves their territory. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The Palestinian Authority says a group of diplomats have come under fire during a visit to the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Delegates from the Middle East and Europe were among those in Jenin when the shots rang out. Now, this footage captures the moment the group of 20 was being briefed on the situation in Jenin, and they were giving interviews to journalists when they heard gunshots. No injuries have been reported. The Israeli military says that its soldiers had to fire warning shots because the delegation deviated from the route that they had been approved for their visit. They have apologized for the incident.
Around the world, pressure is growing on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. More than 20 of Israel's allies signed a letter demanding the full resumption of aid into Gaza immediately, including Britain, where today the Prime Minister went further, calling the situation utterly intolerable.
I want to put on record today that we're horrified by the escalation from Israel. So we must coordinate our response, because this war has gone on for far too long. We cannot allow the people of Gaza to starve.
The United Kingdom has suspended free trade negotiations with Israel and summoned Israel's ambassador.
Mustafa Barghouti is a Palestinian activist, politician and doctor who serves as Secretary General of the Palestinian National Initiative political party. He's a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council and a member of the Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council. He joins us from Ramallah in the West Bank. Welcome to DW. Can we start with your reaction to today's announcement by the UK that it's taking action over Israel, against Israel, over its 11-week blockade of aid into Gaza?
I think we are witnessing a turning point in at the international level regarding what's happening in Gaza. I think the whole world is fed up with the massacres that are taking place there. The fact that the United Nations said today that 14,000 children, Palestinian children, could die in hours because of starvation on Gaza, and the fact that hundreds are dying by Israeli bombardment continuously, this is moving the world. And in addition to that, we have seen huge demonstrations, 600,000 people in London, more than 100,000 in Holland, the largest demonstration since 20 years. What we see is a tsunami, actually, a tsunami of international protest, and maybe a tsunami of sanctions on Israel because of the three war crimes it is committing during the last 19 months. The war crime of genocide, the war crime of collective punishment, and the war crime of ethnic cleansing. And I think what made the big wave, not only the public pressure that is happening, but also the Israeli declared policy by Israeli ministers that reached a level of declaring openly that their intention is the total ethnic cleansing of the population of Gaza.
Okay. So you talked about genocide, collective punishment, and ethnic cleansing, which will hopefully be decided by an international court at some stage. But what? Why now? Because we have seen, we have heard of deaths, we have heard of thousands of deaths, we have seen hundreds of protests around the world. So what is it about now that seems to be moving the international community to say, enough, no more, stop this?
I think three factors have contributed to that. First of all, nobody can hide the crime anymore. It is all over the world on social media. People are seeing the reality of what's happening, seeing the children being killed, the Israeli army shooting and killing children for fun. They're seeing the starvation that people are suffering from, and they've seen the horrible destruction. So first factor is the truth. The truth got to people, regardless of the Israeli propaganda and the American bias to Israel. Second factor, Israel has failed in breaking Palestinian resistance. Although the world has given Israel maybe 19 months, and they've many countries like Britain, United States, Germany, and others continue to supply Israel with weapons and bombs that are used against the civilian population. Israel has failed in breaking the Palestinian resistance or breaking the Palestinian resilience and our determination to stay in our land, regardless of all the atrocities and the huge suffering we are having and the huge losses. But finally, the third factor is definitely the public reaction of Europe. These huge demonstrations that are happening all over Europe and the people in the streets are repeating probably the phenomena that we have seen in protest against the war on Vietnam or the apartheid system in South Africa. It's the same mechanism. It starts with the people, the streets, then it affects the parliaments, and then eventually it affects the positions of the governments. That's exactly what's happening. And by the way, the change is also happening in the states. At the level of the public, there is a huge discrepancy now, a huge gap between the position of the American administration or Congress and the people of the United States.
Just in your last answer there, you talked about Israeli soldiers killing children for fun. This is not, just substantiate that. Where does that come from?
Well, it comes from Yair Golan. Yair Golan is the used to be the deputy head of the Israeli army, the deputy chief of staff of the Israeli army. And he's now heading a party called the Democrats. Yair Golan said today that Israel is moving very quickly into becoming a pariah state, and that this is happening because the Israeli army is allowing its soldiers to kill children to make as a hobby. That's exactly, these are the words of Yair Golan, who used to be the deputy head of the Israeli army.
I saw those quotes, and I see them being dismissed and disputed by the Israeli government. So
of course,
at least
the Israeli government,
no, that's fine. That's fine. At least you've put it into context.
Just to tell you one sentence.
Okay.
The Israeli government is now accusing Yair Golan, who used to be the deputy head of the Israeli army, of being anti-Semite. Can you believe that? That tells you how crazy this Israeli government is becoming and how fascist this Israeli government is becoming.
So much of what Israel has done in Gaza is, they say, to pressure Hamas into making concessions during ceasefire negotiations as a step towards the ultimate goal, they say, of securing the return of Israeli hostages and destroying Hamas's military and political infrastructure. Can there be Palestinian unity without Hamas?
No. Palestinian unity should include everybody. But the issue here is not Hamas. Hamas declared and told us many times that they don't want to be in the government or they don't want to be the government. We already agreed in Beijing for forming a national consensus government that consists of independence without Hamas being in the government. But that government should be for both West Bank and Gaza. That agreement was signed in July by all Palestinian parties and it should be implemented. And that's the way for the so-called day after in Gaza, because it would allow the probability of the possibility of reconstruction of Gaza, but also such a government will have to prepare for free democratic elections where Palestinians, like all people in the world, like German people or British people or even Israeli people, have the chance to choose their leaders freely and democratically. That's the way forward. But regarding pressure on Hamas to achieve ceasefire and to release the Israeli captives, it's there. Hamas declared they are ready to give back all the Israeli captives immediately, not in chunks, not in portions, but immediately all of them in return for stopping the war and the release of a certain number of Palestinian prisoners. By the way, the number of Palestinian prisoners now is 10,100 in Israeli jails, not including many people from Gaza who are kept in concentration camps by Israel. So I don't know why people don't speak about our prisoners as well, who include 400 children who are captives also by Israel, and who include about 4,000 people who are put under administrative detention, which means they are jailed without knowing why, without charges, without a due legal process. Anyhow, we want all the captives out. Israel could get them immediately if they want, if they accept a ceasefire. But that's exactly what Netanyahu doesn't want, because Netanyahu doesn't care about the Israeli captives. That's what the families of the Israeli captives are saying.
Finally, and very briefly, if you wouldn't mind, I'm aware that you're an advocate of non-violent resistance. I wonder what you feel when you hear Israel, backed by the United States, say that it wants to clear Palestinians out of Gaza and take over the whole territory. Can that be resisted without violence?
I believe in nonviolence. I believe in democracy. I believe in human rights. Not because we don't have the right to resist Israel in every possible way according to international law. International law says that people under occupation, under people who are threatened with ethnic cleansing, have the right to resist even in military forms, as long as they respect international law and international humanitarian law. But I believe in nonviolence because I believe it's the most effective way in our case. Nevertheless, I think it's time for the world to stop this crime as you have described it, the ethnic cleansing of the people of Gaza. That is the worst crime, not only in modern history, but in history in general, and it should be stopped. And this Israeli fascist government should be stopped. And I can see that there is now a tsunami of solidarity with Palestine, unprecedented, and I hope it will be effective.
Thank you for joining us, a Palestinian politician and activist, Mustafa Barghouti. Thank you so much.
That report and interview were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, as well as most podcast sites. On to NHK Japan. Nippon Steel says it wants to invest $14 billion into the U.S. steel if Trump allows the sale. the World Health Organization voted to be better prepared to deal with future pandemics, but the U.S. did not even attend the hearings. NHK Japan.
Reuters reports that Nippon Steel is planning to pump $14 billion into U.S. steel if the Trump administration greenlights its bid for the company. The Japanese steelmaker's pledge is a jump from its most recent offer of $2.7 billion. The report says the latest plan includes investing up to $4 billion in a new mill. Former President Joe Biden blocked the merger in January, citing national security concerns, and President Donald Trump continued to apply the brakes. He ordered the Committee on Foreign Investment to do a new review. It will be finished by Wednesday, and then Trump will have about 2 weeks to decide on the fate of the deal.
Members of the World Health Organization want to be better prepared to fight potential new infectious diseases. They have unanimously approved a treaty called the Pandemic Agreement.
It's adopted.
After the coronavirus pandemic, the members have been discussing the agreement for 3 years to better respond to the next pandemic. The treaty, approved in a plenary session, calls on countries to promote the transfer of knowledge and technology for the production of vaccines to developing countries. It also aims to launch a new framework for countries to share information on pathogens to help accelerate the production of vaccines and medicines.
Today, you have sent a loud message that multilateralism not only works, but is the only way to find shared solutions to shared threats. With this agreement, we are better prepared for a pandemic than any generation in history.
But the United States did not attend the plenary session. The WHO's largest financial contributor has announced its intention to withdraw from the organization. The Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., said in a video message that the U.S. will not participate in the treaty. He criticized the WHO, saying it has become mired in international politics and capitulated to political pressure from China. He called on other ministers to create new institutions.
I urge the world's health ministers and the WHO to take our withdrawal from the organization as a wake-up call. We've already been in contact with like-minded countries, and we encourage others to consider joining us.
The member states will decide the details of the agreement by next year's plenary session. The treaty will take effect after ratification by 60 members.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK is available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, like a listener in New York City and a subscriber in Cleveland did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show on the airwaves. Please help if you can. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please help support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. The trial of former Brazilian President Bolsonaro is underway. Charges that he planned a coup and tried to overturn results of the 2022 election. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The trial of former Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has begun. Charges that he planned a coup d'etat and led a criminal organization to overturn the results of the October 2022 election, in which he was defeated by current President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The country's Supreme Court is hearing testimony from high-ranking Brazilian military and political figures over the next 2 weeks. The 70-year-old far-right leader, a former army captain who governed Brazil from 2019 to 2022, could face up to 40 years in prison if he is convicted. Bolsonaro, of course, denies the allegations, claiming he was a victim of political persecution. More than 80 witnesses are testifying by video conference, including Generals Marco Antonio Fier Gomes and Carlos de Almeida Batista Jr., who served as commanders of the Army and Air Force under Bolsonaro. In recent statements to federal police, both men said that Bolsonaro had raised the hypothetical possibility of using legal means to annul the 2022 election and justify a military intervention. According to prosecutors, the plot included plans to declare a state of emergency, hold new elections, and assassinate President Lula da Silva. The 900-page federal police report details the scheme, which prosecutors say ultimately collapsed due to a lack of support within the military. Charges also encompass the January 8, 2023 riots in Brasilia, when thousands of Bolsonaro supporters stormed Congress, the Supreme Court, and the presidential palace 1 week after Lula's inauguration. Although Bolsonaro, a close ally of U.S. President Donald Trump when they were both in power, was in the United States at the time, prosecutors argue that he backed the violence, supported it, calling it the last hope of those seeking to overturn the election and return him to power. Seven of Bolsonaro's former military men declared they had a desire to return to politics, but speaking to reporters, he said the charges are a telenovela scenario, warned that a conviction would be a death penalty, political and physical. Bolsonaro also heavily criticized when he was Brazil's leader under the COVID-19 pandemic, when his policies and his spread of misinformation, just like Donald Trump, contributed to the nation having the highest overall death toll in Latin America, the second highest in the world after the United States. Earlier this month, Bolsonaro was recently discharged from a hospital after undergoing major abdominal surgery, the latest in a series of procedures stemming from a stabbing attack in 2018.
That report was from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website's working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report's been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.